Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon Central Time, and there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
A great noon hour to you, and welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Ryan Thomas. You'll hear Neil Stavem in just moments. We're excited today by the chance to bring you conversations with two distinguished, nationally recognized men of faith. Dr. Ben Carson is a celebrated, now retired neurosurgeon and a recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, as well as a popular author and speaker. He talks to Neil later this hour about faith and leadership, the state of our nation, and his upcoming trip to the Twin Cities. But first, it's the former governor of Arkansas, nationally syndicated radio commentator, host of Fox News Huckabee, and 2008 presidential candidate, Governor Mike Huckabee. While on campus recently at University of Northwestern St. Paul, he joined Neil in a sit-down conversation that ranged from the key importance of education to ministry and to the intersection of faith in the public arena. Now, here's Governor Mike Huckabee with our own Neil Stavem on Connecting Faith.
It's an honor to spend some time today talking with Governor Mike Huckabee, and we had an opportunity to hear him on campus at the university today, and want to just talk a little bit about your passion for leadership and ministry. You're speaking at a leadership event, but I want to start, I think, with talk a bit about higher education, because I know a little bit about your background. You were the first in your family to actually complete several degrees. What are your thoughts about higher education today and how important it is?
Well, I think it's critically important, not so much that you're going to learn everything you need to know, but higher education is sort of like it's like a passport to a career and to a future. Higher education can take many forms. It may take the traditional university role. It may take the community college direction, where a person learns maybe some type of craft or skill, whether it's HVAC, bricklaying. So, I mean, it can mean a lot of things. But anybody who has only a high school education is going to greatly limit their capacity for income, for job opportunities, and sooner or later they're going to go back and get some other skills. They're not going to get everything they need in high school. And I think a lot of people need to understand that higher education, particularly if they go to a liberal arts school, will prepare them not just for a specific vocation. It will prepare them for life. And that's one of the reasons I'm very committed to schools like Northwestern. It mirrors the kind of school I went to. I went to a small private Christian college in Arkansas, about the same number of students. I think there's 1,800 or so full-time on-campus students here, around 1,600 at the school where I went. There's a great value in that. And the value, first, is in the fact that it's a liberal arts education, where you'll be exposed to many disciplines, many areas of study. You're going to be well steeped in the world that you're going to live in and be knowledgeable and conversant in so many different fields, as opposed to going and narrowly focusing on one thing and then being a very one-dimensional person.
You know, one of the things that Northwestern is committed to is training up leaders for the next generation, if you will, and to have an impact in the world and culture. As Christians, having an impact in the culture seems maybe a little more challenging today, particularly if somebody pursues elected office. Talk a little bit about your journey there.
Well, Christians are no longer the cultural majority. They may be numerically a majority in America, but they're not a cultural majority, and that's largely because they have surrendered. They've abdicated the fight. They've decided that they'd rather hide than stand. And unfortunately, the result of that is that the loudest voices tend to be the voices of leadership, not because they have better ideas, not because they represent a majority, but because they represented the people who show up. A lot of Christians just don't show up. And I don't understand why people who are believers are fearful of the elements of the world. God makes it very clear that God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power, love, and a sound mind. And we should believe that. We should rest on that as a promise from God. And if we do, we'll say all the arenas are open to us. We may have to work a little harder to get in them, may have to work even harder to be able to be effective and successful in them, but we should shoot for excellence in whatever we do. Never, ever shoot for anything less than the highest level of excellence, not because it makes us more important, because that's how I think we bring glory to God.
It does seem, I guess, in today's culture that there's not so much a disinterest in religion as there's sort of a aggressive attack toward it, maybe in some ways, in terms of limiting its its public influence. Your private religion is fine, but so for someone to try to live out their Christian ideals in a political environment, what does that look like?
In one way, it's easier for this reason, because I don't have to wake up every day and decide what I want to believe. So I tell people, from that standpoint, I find it easier, because I'm not dependent upon the latest poll constantly pivoting my positions and principles on issues. Now, it is much more difficult in the practical end of it, because I have to realize that I'm going to be butting my head against a cultural norm that no longer is cordial, in fact, that is openly hostile and intolerant of my view as a Christian. It used to be that the Christian, even broader, the Judeo-Christian worldview was the driving force behind our culture. Then it became that it was accepted. Then it became it was tolerated, and now it's not tolerated. And there's open hostility to people who hold to traditional understandings of things like the origins of life, about marriage and family, even about the economic issues of generosity and unselfishness. Those are foreign. I mean, we teach now, you're out there on yourself. It's basically economic Darwinism. This is survival of the fittest, and it's tragic. We've taken it from the biological realm to the economic realm, and so now you see people who are just getting crushed by an economy that isn't geared toward bringing prosperity to people who work. It's about, if you can grab it, go get it, and if you can step over people or on people to get more of it, then do it. And if you have a world that's run by an economy without morality, without ethics and principles that drive it, it's an economy that's going to crash, because sooner or later, the people who have gotten to the top dishonestly, through corruption, through cronyism, will destroy each other. There's no long-term way that this survives.
So how do you address moral issues, framework kind of foundational issues, in a society that's not really interested in even having that discussion?
I think we have to talk about it from a practical standpoint. When I'm speaking, for example, on a secular college campus, whether it's an Ivy League school or some campus that is openly liberal and hostile toward me, which is most of them, what I find is if I answer their questions with questions and I challenge them to take their position and then let's walk that through to its logical conclusion and ask, can you live with that? Are you sure that your position that you have based on what I think, what I feel, what I believe, because it's typically very subjective and emotional, let's objectify that. Let's now take your position based on feel, believe, think, and let's walk it down to its logical conclusion. And when we get there, you tell me, can you live with this? Because if you can, there's nothing I can do to challenge you. If you can, or at least I make you think about it, then you have to find what is it that you can believe that you can live with. Because I don't think a lot of people have ever thought through where their present position takes them. And let me just give one example of that. Let's say that we take the position, or we don't, but some student says, well, I believe a woman's right to choose. I think that a woman can have an abortion any time. I said, okay, let's follow that through. What is the basis upon which she can do that? Well, it's her body. Is it biologically her body? It is not. So let's objectify that. Biologically, that child has a different DNA schedule, may have a different blood type. So from your 10th grade biology class, you know that it's not a biological part of the mother. She hosts the child, but it is not a part of her body like her appendix or her lungs or kidneys are. So let's at least be biologically honest. When did life begin? Say, we can't know. Actually, we can. 23 male, 23 female chromosomes, they come together. There's a 46 chromosome plan that creates the DNA of that child. When does that happen? Happens at conception. That's 10th grade biology. We don't have to, this is not a theological issue here. Let's just stick to the science, because you're always telling, Christians, you guys need to believe in science. Okay, I'm with you. Let's believe in some science here. What does that embryo have the capacity to become? It'll never be a puppy. It'll never be a dolphin. It can't be a stalk of broccoli. It's only one thing that it is, that's human. Even if you reject that and you say, well, but it's really not a life unless it's viable. Okay, what is viability? Viability today is very different than it was 30 years ago, very different than it was 15 years ago. So as the viability changes, is that the basis of the morality of whether it's right or wrong? And what about late term? I mean, the problem is we as Christians tend to not want to engage in a meaningful discussion and dialogue. We shouldn't be afraid. Truth's on our side. We never have to feel like that we're outmanned intellectually on what I consider the great moral principles of life.
You spent some time, obviously, as a governor, one of the youngest governors, I think.
At the time, yeah.
And I'm interested, and you're here at Northwestern talking a little about leadership and to leaders, and wondering if there were principles that you used as a governor, maybe some foundational principles, and were they the same as when you were pastoring, and do they inform your life today?
Very much. The first day that I took office as governor, I assembled my staff, and I said, we're going to put a frame up out here in the outer office. And in that frame, we're going to put a photo, and there's an inscription on it. It's our boss. And I want you to walk by there every day, and I want you to remember who the boss is. And they all were sort of looking and nodding. I said, now, if you think my photo is in that frame, you're wrong. My photo will never be in that frame. I said, every few days, we'll change the photo, but it'll be of a welder, a truck driver, a couple celebrating a 50th anniversary, a scout troop. I said, here's what I want you to understand. The boss is not the guy sitting in the corner office. I work for the same guys you work for. Our boss is the nearly 3 million citizens of this state who pay our salaries. We serve them. We serve at their pleasure. When they walk in here, they are not our interruption. They're not interfering with us. They're not bothering us. They're not keeping us from our job because they are our job. Treat every person who walks in this place with dignity and respect. Treat everyone, I don't care if they smell bad and they come in off the street, treat them as if they're the richest person in Arkansas and you'll never have to apologize. And treat everybody like you want to be treated. So I said, what we're going to do is practice the simple golden rule that my mother drilled into me when I was a kid. You do unto others as you'd have others do unto you. And if you see somebody walking into your office, you ask, if this were reversed and I were that person, and they were me, how would I want to be treated? I said, that's what you do. So I think there were many ways, and that was kind of the foundation upon which I built the staff, and I ensured that we never speak disrespectfully to each other. I said, I don't want to have profanity in the office. If you feel like you have to say those things, you do it, off the clock. I can't tell you what you can and can't say on your private time, but I can tell you we're not going to entertain that kind of conversation. It's coarse. It's degrading and demeaning, and it creates a very hostile workplace that we want to have. I want to treat people with respect. I don't want people's ears to be used as a trash can. So there were a lot of ways in which, I don't think it was being dictatorial or autocratic, but I just said we want to have an environment that is friendly and cordial to the values that a six-year-old could come in our office at any time, and we'd never have to say, oops, we're sorry we said that. So there are ways that we can infect, if you will, our workplace with godly principles that aren't over the top. You're not asking people to get on their knees at their desk every day and pray or, have an offering. You're just simply saying, look, there's a level of conduct maybe influenced by my being a believer, but I'm not imposing you to believe, but I'm asking you to behave like a person who shows maturity and respect for others.
Former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee is my guest today on Connecting Faith, and we'll talk more in a moment.
Hi, I'm Dick Whitmer, General Manager of Faith Radio. You and I both know that living for Jesus is a lifelong journey, and we're committed to helping you connect faith to life with access when you need it. And to help you keep your faith strong throughout the day, we'd like to send you a Live by Faith wristband. It's free. Wear it each day as a reminder that you're on a journey of faith. If you would like your free wristband, visit myfaithradio.com to request yours. We'll get it out to you as soon as possible.
Maybe you've heard that Faith Radio's on Twitter. It's an increasingly popular way to stay connected to your friends and your interests online and on your phone. It's simple and easy. It sends you short updates on the latest from your favorite Faith Radio teachers, original shows, and events. What about giving it a try today? Just search for My Faith Radio on Twitter or head to twitter.com/MyFaithRadio to follow us today.
We're Connecting today with Mike Huckabee, former pastor, former governor of Arkansas, one-time presidential candidate, and now serves as host of Huckabee on the Fox News Channel.
I'm interested maybe just to take a minute to share a little bit about your story, your background. You were a pastor for a number of years. You were in radio for a while.
Yeah.
How did that journey develop?
My first career was broadcasting, and I did that not only through high school, college, and grad school, but my first career out of education was running an ad agency and doing radio and television work and working for a lot of Christian ministries and organizations. And then through kind of a strange process, one of my side trips was 12 years in the pastorate. It came about in the most unusual way, but the short version is, you know, that I ended up pastoring two churches, each for 6 years. It was like grad school for me, because that's where I really saw human life at a level that there's no other way to see it. When later, my third life, politics happened, there were a lot of people who thought that, well, being, you know, a pastor kind of means you don't really understand. I said, no, being a pastor means that I can put a name and a face on every social pathology that exists. You want to talk about pregnant teenagers? They came to me before they told their parents. You want to talk about young families who are struggling with their marriage, keeping it together? I talk to those people. I talk to the elderly people who are having to decide whether to, you know, take life support off a loved one. I saw families who lost children. I saw families who had children that were on drugs and had to be sent to prison. There's nothing that you can present to me that I didn't see every day in my life as a pastor. Those are real problems, real issues. I think I understand them better than somebody who's never actually been into the house of a person where there's no food. Easy to say, oh, people in America aren't hungry. But if you've been into some homes where there's not a bite of food in the house, you could say, no, there are some people in this country, and they're hungry. So there is poverty. It's real, and it hurts people. So to be sensitized to that and to understand it firsthand, I think made me a much better governor when I served.
Is being governor or pursuing elected office the same level of calling as calling to be a pastor?
Well, I think it is. You know, I always am amazed when people act like that the only thing God calls you to do is to get a paycheck from a church. And I'm thinking, really, where did that come from? Is that a biblical view? It's not. It's a cultural view that we've created in America, that the ministers are the people who get a church paycheck. You know, they're either pastors, they're missionaries, or they're, now we kind of add in the staff members, even though, you know, where do you find that in the Scripture either? Look, this is part of our culture. It has nothing to do with the Scripture. Calling is a calling to follow Jesus Christ. It's not a calling to a particular job description that's outlined on a piece of paper and signed off by a personnel committee. So, I kind of push back on this notion that, well, if you're not getting your paycheck from a church vocation, you're not serving God as much as you could. Well, I see people every day that are bankers, who are, you know, people who are police officers, all sorts of professions, teachers. I think they're serving God, and they're taking the Lord to the workplace, and they're really having impact. They're taking light to darkness. How can that not be a calling in a ministry? I think every Christian is called to follow and to take some responsibility. I go to a church down in Florida now where you can't just join the church without taking on a responsibility in the church. They don't ask you if, you know, would you like to do something? They ask, what would you like to do? And they'll give you a menu of options, and you can choose that which you think matches your spiritual gifts. But sitting around and just showing up to come to church and being entertained is not one of those options. So if you want to choose that, then they consider you a visitor. Members, it means something. And I like that. I've never been in the church where that was an absolute requirement. I find it refreshing.
Well, follow up on the issue of calling, because I'm curious if calling to pursue, say, a governorship or the presidency, whatever, and you don't win, should you expect to win if it's a calling?
The expectation has to be obedient. The calling is not for a conclusion or an outcome. The calling is to the process, not to the end result, because you don't know what that's going to be. And also, I think we have to recognize that the end result may be seen in eternity, not on a temporal level. So if a person says, well, God's called me to run for office, okay, great. If they don't win, did God not call them? Were they wrong? No. They may have been wrong. I can't say that. But winning or losing, unless they went out and announced it. But see, I think that's a big mistake when we say not only God has called me, but here's the outcome that I can guarantee you. I can't guarantee anything. I can only be faithful to that which is in front of me. And if I look at, did Moses say, yes, I'm going to lead my people out of bondage? So did he? Well, yeah, but it was a little awkward to take him 40 years to make what should have been an 11-day journey. So was that the outcome that he expected? I don't think so. You can go all through the scripture and see where people followed and did what God wanted, but the pathway was very different than what they anticipated, and many times what people around them anticipated. But that's part of the challenge of faith. If it works out like you want it to, that's easy to believe. It's when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thrown into the fiery furnace and they said, our God will deliver us. But the second part of that, but even if he doesn't, he's still our God. That's what it means to follow. It's, yes, I believe God will deliver us. But you know what? Whether he delivers us or not, I still trust him as my God. That's, I think, the approach we take, whether it's running for office or taking on a job or whatever it is we do. We have a hope, we have an expectation, but we also realize God is sovereign, we aren't.
There's a kind of a short-term mentality, it seems, in our society today. Certainly in business, it's all short-term profits. Maybe in politics as well, easy to sort of throw in the towel.
Mm-hmm.
You talked a lot about faithfulness, about staying mm-hmm. true. Say some words about what it means to faithfully carry on the calling that God's given you.
For me, I think it's keeping a focus not on the circumstances, because frankly there are a lot of circumstances right now that would be very discouraging for a believer. Seeing major cultural shifts, people abandoning the definition of marriage. And many people who say, I'm a Christian, but you know, who am I to tell people they can't love each other? You're no one to tell people. But neither are you someone who can rewrite the Bible. And that's what I find amazing, is that people act like that they are more afraid to tell human beings what they can't feel than they are to tell God what he can say. And so, you know, I don't have hate or intolerance toward anybody. I really don't. But when people try to press me on the issue of why don't I just kind of go ahead and give in to this, I say, you know, I'd love to be popular. I'd love to be loved. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm a politician enough that you like to be liked. But there comes a point at which you have to say, there's some things I can negotiate, some things I can't. And it's not that I can't negotiate because I'm a stubborn fool. I can't negotiate them because I don't own them. I don't own that issue. I can only negotiate with that which I have control over. I don't have control over the definition of marriage because that's something that I find in the scripture, and I haven't seen that it's been revised or edited. And until it is, I'm going to have to stand where it's always stood.
Final word maybe to the students here at Northwestern or other students today in terms of the future before them. What advice, what encouragement, maybe challenge would you give them?
Soak up everything they can while they're here, because they will look back someday, and the only regrets won't be that they didn't cut class. They'll never regret that, you know, gee, I should have cut more classes, or I should have experimented with more crazy things. Their regret will be, I didn't learn another language. The regret will be, I could have made an A in that and really mastered, you know, medieval literature. A lot of things that they're doing, they don't think they're going to need or want or ever be valuable to them. They'll be shocked at how those things will come back to be valuable to them. The other thing I'd say to them is that just remember that everything you say and do will be used against you. And so not just whether you're going to be in public life, certainly and especially if you are, but even if you're not, everything they post on Facebook, everything they tweet, every photo they take, they need to be prepared for them to see it in 30 years and for their kids to see it in 30 years. It's really hard to tell, you know, your student, don't go out there and do crazy stuff at spring break when, you know, the kid can pull up pictures and say, hey, Mom, was this you in spring break? Is this what you're talking about? I've seen a lot of people who have some serious regrets about what they thought was innocent behavior. There's no such thing as sinful behavior ever being innocent. It's not innocent. It's hurtful, it's painful, and comes back to bite you.
Still playing bass guitar now and
then? Oh, yeah.
Good.
Regularly, you
good,
bet.
Good. Governor, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks. Governor Mike Huckabee talking to us today from the University of Northwestern.
Honored to spend a little time today talking to Dr. Ben Carson. He's a professor of neurosurgery, plastic surgery, oncology, and pediatrics, and the director of pediatric neurosurgery, Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions, author of a number of books, including Gifted Hands, Think Big, The Big Picture, the bestseller America the Beautiful, Rediscovering What Made This Nation Great. He has a new book coming out called One Nation, What We Can Do, What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. And he's going to be in the area speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Family Council. We'll talk more about that in a moment. But, Dr. Carson, I know that the new book, One Nation, perhaps came out of your opportunity to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast just a year ago. That was that was a speech that changed a lot of things, didn't it?
It really did. And clearly it resonated with just millions and millions of Americans. And people began to think, is it possible that maybe there's some common sense left in America? And I think that's why it's resonated so much. And what we have to do is take advantage of that, continue to awaken people and help people to have courage, because what has happened is people have been beaten into submission, you know, by the PC police, the media. And we no longer have a nation where people feel perfectly free to express themselves.
Well, I know that you talk about being able to have respectful discussions with no subject off limits, and it does seem like there are, there's always been different viewpoints, but it does seem now that there are some topics we can't even discuss.
Well, this is all planned. You know, if you read a lot of the works of Neo Marxists, probably the most famous of which is Saul Alinsky, they say never have a discussion with your opponent because that humanizes them, and your job is to demonize them. And by continuing to demonize people, you make them afraid. You know, people who believe in traditional marriage, they're afraid to say that because they'll be labeled homophobic. You're pro-life, some people are afraid to say that because you'll be labeled anti-woman. You know, if you say something in opposition to a progressive black person, you're a racist. Or if you're a black person, you say something against a progressive black person, you've lost your mind. So, I mean, it's just it's sad, the state to which we've devolved. But it's not here. We can put something in place that makes sense again, but it will require courage. And we have to think back to, you know, those people who preceded us. You know, why are we free today? Because they had courage. They were willing to stand before opposition. We have to be willing to do the same thing.
You know, I was thinking, Dr. Carson, your world as a physician, a surgeon, that I would think maybe many decisions are sort of clear-cut, I guess no pun intended, but does that work sort of in politics where it seems like there's maybe lots of gray areas, or how do you deal with compromise in...
Well, you know, I will say in my medical career, I had many situations that were not clear-cut and engendered a lot of controversy. You know, when I first started advocating a certain type of operation for achondroplastic dwarfs. These are little people, in its most common form. 7% of the babies would die spontaneously because their brain stems were being compressed by bone at the base of the skull. And the way that people tried to fix that usually made the problem worse. And we came up with a different way of doing it. And you know, there was a lot of opposition and outrage. You surgeons are the ones who kill these people. What's wrong with you? But, you know, we persisted despite all the opposition and complaints to the dean, to the president of the hospital, to the Maryland Medical Society, even to the AMA, until we were finally able to get enough cases, expose the data, and demonstrate that none of the patients had died that we operated on, and they all were doing very well. And that kind of ended that argument. One of the nice things about medicine is people do tend to respond to data. And you don't necessarily get that in the political world. Everything is ideologically driven. So even if you have data demonstrating that your ideal isn't working, what they tend to do is just double down and say, we didn't do enough of it. And, of course, that's a real problem. But I think that there are enough logical people, people with common sense. All we have to do is get them to have courage.
Courage and the convictions, and civility. It seems like those are three important C words that we need to have in balance in some way, don't we?
We definitely do. And the people need to understand that we, the people of America, are not each other's enemies. The enemies are those who try to make us think we're each other's enemies, who try to divide us up into every possible category. There's a war on women, age wars, income wars, racial wars, and as long as they can keep us divided and at each other's throats, they win. And they know that. And this is one of the ways that they fundamentally change America. We've got to be smart enough to be able to see through that. And what we have to start doing is learning to engage in civil discussion. Even if you disagree with somebody, have a civil discussion with them. Talk about why you believe what you believe. Listen to why they believe what they believe. A lot of times you'll find that you're not very far apart, maybe not far apart at all. And that's the way that you work out solutions. We have to learn how to work out things that work for all of us and not allow ourselves to be made into enemies.
You know, finding that commonality, I guess there's also the sometimes there are, you know, various viewpoints that need to be honored and respected, I guess. I'm thinking about maybe a religious viewpoint that the world says, well, pragmatically, we'll just go with the 51% as opposed to honoring some distinctives. So talk a little bit more about what that looks like. We want to become one nation, but we do want to recognize our differences as well.
Yeah, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with having differences. I always say if two people believe the same thing about everything, one of them isn't necessary. You know, that indicates a lack of brain function if you agree with somebody about everything. And we need to understand that possibility. You know, during the National Prayer Breakfast speech, you know, I said the only way that an eagle can fly is that it has two wings, a left wing and a right wing. Well, you know, there's nothing wrong with being conservative or being liberal. It doesn't make you into each other's enemies. But we need to learn how to accommodate each other. You know, you look at something, for instance, like Obamacare. There was no attempt to accommodate the other side at all. And I talked to one of the high administration officials before it was passed, and I said, there are several things in here that make a lot of sense. And I think a lot of people from every viewpoint would agree with them. Why don't we start with those things? Make that the foundation. And that can be done on a bipartisan basis. And then let's build together something that works for everybody. I say if you do it the other way, you just jam it through on one party with unanimous opposition from the other side, all you're going to do is create animosity, which will last for decades. You're going to probably lose the House. You may lose the Senate. And he said, you're probably right, but, and that's always the problem, that word, but, this is Washington and this is politics. Well, that's the problem. When you take something as valuable, as important as healthcare, which is the most important thing you have, and you make that into a political football, then, of course, you end up with a political circus, which is what we have. And we have to learn how to not allow ourselves to be manipulated by politicians. I don't care whether they're Democrat or Republican politicians. Politicians who manipulate people are not good people.
I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about, you know, can we expect moral behavior and outcomes from people on a moral base? I mean, do we expect non-Christians to act like or live like Christians?
Well, we can certainly ask them what is the basis of their action. Put them on the hot seat. A lot of times you'll find that maybe they do believe and they just didn't know that they did believe. Because when you throw God out, when you throw out God's law, when you throw out moral codes, then what you become the God. You are the one who gets to decide what's right and wrong. And, of course, this is exactly what the neo-Marxists want. If you read the writings of Karl Marx, Vladimir Lenin, particularly Saul Alinsky, and you see what are they trying to do? They say America is very strong because they have a strong faith-based Judeo-Christian values. And in order for us to fundamentally change America, it will be necessary to marginalize their faith. And hence you've seen for the last few decades an intense war on faith in this country, trying to marginalize it, trying to make it seem like people who have faith really are not intellectually very capable. What they don't look at is a nation that was a bunch of ragtag militiamen who defeated the most powerful empire on earth, largely because of their faith. A nation that went from nowhere to the pinnacle of the world much faster than anybody else had done, largely because of their values. Now, as that faith and those values are being discarded, look what's happening to our nation.
Dr. Ben Carson is my guest today. He's professor of neurosurgery and plastic surgery, oncology, pediatrics, and director of pediatric neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions. He's authored several books. His story is told in the film Gifted Hands. His new book just coming out is called One Nation, What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. And we'll continue our conversation with Dr. Ben Carson in a moment here on Connecting Faith.
Here's a quick reminder of the contest rules for drawings and promotions on Faith Radio. If you want something from Faith Radio, wait 30 days before entering again. Multiple entries by the same person will be discarded unless otherwise stated. Winning entries may be used for promotional purposes. Faith Radio is not responsible for problems with computers, phones, or mail delivery, but we'll do our best to make your experience a good one. Find a full list of contest rules online in full legal speak at our website, myfaithradio.com.
This summer, your students' future can take off with Northwestern's Early College Program. They'll earn college credit while still in high school, and these credits are offered at a deep discount. They'll take classes online from first-rate faculty and can learn by themselves or in a group. They could even take the classes while sitting by the pool. To take advantage of this great opportunity, sign up by April 30th at unwsp.edu/early college. University of Northwestern, St. Paul. Your life on purpose.
This is Connecting Faith, and we're connecting with noted neurosurgeon and professor and best-selling author Dr. Ben Carson. His latest book is called One Nation, What We All Can Do to Save America's Future. Dr. Carson, I'd be interested in maybe you telling, just reviewing a bit about your story, because you grew up in poverty, and I know that you talked about, you know, there are a lot of people that still seem to have some anger today. Are the circumstances, reasons for that anger the same as when you were growing up as a child?
I think largely the same. You know, growing up in the inner city in Detroit and Boston with a mother who had only a third grade education but was an extremely hard worker and refused to be a victim under any circumstances and refused to allow us to be victims, would never accept excuses. And the key thing is, you know, she was observant. And she noticed in the homes that she cleaned, and she cleaned two or three homes every day, she noticed that those people tended to do a lot of reading and studying and not a lot of just sitting around wasting time and watching TV. And she, after praying for wisdom, came up with the idea of turning off the TV and making us read books. Now, needless to say, we were not enthusiastic about that. But in those days, you had to do what your parents told you, so we had to do it, whether we wanted to or not. And interestingly, as I started reading those books, a major transition occurred because I started reading particularly about people of accomplishment. And I began to see a correlation, begin to understand that the person who has the most of you in life is you. And I began to think, you know, I don't have to listen to all these people around me who are talking about how everything is against them and, you know, woe is me. I said, I don't have to do that at all. I can plan out my course. I can decide what I want to do, and I can get it accomplished. And it made a huge difference in who I was. And the same thing happened with my brother, needless to say. But the anger part, I was selfish. It was about me. You know, somebody's in my space. Somebody took my thing. Me, my, I. And the day that I tried to stab another teenager because he had angered me, changed the radio station I'm listening to, it really came flooding home to me that I would never be successful as long as I was the center of everything. And I learned after praying earnestly that day and reading from the book of Proverbs that you can easily take yourself out of the center of the circle so that everything is not about you. And you can start learning to look at things from other people's points of view. And it makes a huge difference. It's almost impossible to get angry when you start doing that. Even when people are being totally nasty and obnoxious, you know, I just look at them and I say, they used to be a cute little baby. I wonder what happened to them. And it kind of just diffuses it in my mind. I just look at them. I feel sorry for them.
You overcame some pretty incredible odds. Do you think that maybe skews your perspective on others who are struggling, or do you have maybe more compassion having grown up in abject poverty?
Well, I think I have a lot more compassion. And it's one of the reasons that, you know, I'm willing to go out there where a lot of people are not, even to be ostracized by some people, because I realize that somebody has to do that. Somebody has to be willing to present the alternative to the victimization. You know, America became great because of the can-do attitude, not the what-can-you-do-for-me attitude. And somebody has to be willing to say that, and not only say that, but to show that. And it works, and to create ways for people to escape. It's why we, for instance, put in reading rooms all over the country, and we particularly target Title I schools where a lot of the kids come from homes with no books. They go to a school with no library. They're amongst that 20-30% who drop out. That's not doing anybody any good. And so we put in these reading rooms that are fascinating places. No little kid would possibly pass them up. And they get points for the amount of time they spend in there, the number of books they read. And they can trade them in for prizes. In the beginning, they're doing it for the prizes, but it doesn't take long before it begins to have a profound effect on their academics. And that's what we're trying to do. Because if you can get a kid to start loving reading when they're young, the likelihood of them dropping out of school diminishes very significantly.
You're passionate about education. I'm just wondering, in terms of, you know, solutions to our nation, you address issues like our debt, healthcare, obviously another big issue, education. Are there, you know, are all of those equally important, or is there one that has priority in your mind?
Well, they're all incredibly important, but in terms of what could destroy our nation quickly, is our debt. And I don't think most people have any clue how big a problem this is. The numbers are so staggering, you can't even comprehend them. You know, if you try to pay back $17 trillion at a rate of $10 million per day, it would take you 4,700 years. I mean, that gives you some idea of what you're dealing with. And here's what people don't understand. The only reason we can sustain a debt of that nature is because we are the world reserve currency, which means we have the ability to print money. Nobody else can do that. If Greece could print money, they wouldn't have a problem. At least they wouldn't know they had a problem. They'd still have it. They wouldn't know it, just like we don't know it. But suppose next week China says, you know, we've been buying up these American treasury securities, basically loaning them trillions of dollars. They're not showing any evidence of growing their economy or accepting any kind of fiscal responsibility. So we're terminating our relationship financially with them. Imagine what would happen. And then others would jump on that boat. And in a really very short period of time, our dollar would just be worthless. And, you know, what happened with Occupy Wall Street would be a walk in the park compared to what you would see. There would be a run on the banks. There would be telling people, look, you know, we're good. We can guarantee it. Nobody would believe a word of it. It would be panic. You know, OPEC, all of those people would sit down and say, we've got to come up with a new standard. Gold would become the standard. There are reasons that gold was removed as a standard. All of those things would come flooding back. You know, it would be a total disaster, and that could occur almost overnight. You know, people say, well, you know, in the past when, you know, you had a great nation that went to decline, it would take decades or even 100 years for that decline to occur. So, you know, we've got time. Not true, because in the past, we didn't have the internet. We didn't have lightning fast news dissemination. We have that now. Ask Lehman Brothers how long it took for their demise. Not very long at all.
Dr. Carson, you've talked several times about courage, and I'm wondering what, you know, the average person, what their courage will do. It seems like, you know, some of these issues are decided at much higher levels than what, you know, you or I might be involved in. So how can our courage make a difference in changing the way our nation's operating?
Well, first of all, you know, courage comes in not allowing yourself to be intimidated, which is what political correctness is all about. You know, to go out there, you need to be willing to talk about what you believe, but more than just talk about it. You know, get together with neighbors and friends, with church members, just like they did in the pre-revolutionary days. Have community meetings. Talk about what kind of nation you want to pass on to your children and what are you willing to do for it. That's how you encourage each other. Make sure that, and you have those meetings, that somebody comes armed with information about how your representative voted. Not how they said they voted, but how did they actually vote? And how does that register with the way that you feel? So you have to be proactive. You have to become knowledgeable. You know, I ask people to start reading. Read American history. Read world history. Read about civics. Read about geography. If you spend a half an hour a day doing that, it is unbelievable what will happen to you in a year's time. And knowledge is a formidable enemy of falsehood and a formidable ally of truth. And that's why the founders of this nation said that we can only survive with a well-educated populace. And if we ever become other than that, the nature of the country will change. Why did they say that? Because they knew that slick politicians and dishonest media would be easily able to manipulate people. You cannot manipulate people who are well educated. So that's one of the things. And it's so much easier just to sit around and be part of the pop culture. You know, I want to find out who's on Dancing with the Stars and who's playing basketball and all this kind of silly stuff that makes no difference whatsoever, instead of arming yourself with the kind of knowledge that will allow us to continue to flourish as a free society. Freedom is not free. It requires work.
Dr. Ben Carson and his wife have co-written a new book called One Nation, What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. It's coming out soon. And he's also written the bestseller, America the Beautiful, Rediscovering What Made This Nation Great. In fact, he has a prescription for just what the doctor ordered for our nation. We'll be coming to the area, speaking at the Minnesota Family Council annual dinner called Restoring Our Foundations, a Prescription for America. And Dr. Carson, just maybe just say a word about your presentation there and invite some people to come.
Well, I'll be talking, you know, about the things that all of us should know about this nation, but relatively few of us do, and about what kind of things are likely to happen if we continue down that we're going down right now. It's almost as if we read the book, The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire, and we're going through page by page saying, okay, this is what they did. Let's make sure we do that. And the fact of the matter is, talking about how we can actually change course. The wonderful thing about human beings and about our brain, we have these huge frontal lobes. We actually have the ability to process information from the past and the present and then project into the future a plan based on those things, unlike animals who just tend to react to what's going on. We have to stop acting like that and start acting like the individuals that we were created to be, utilizing the intellect, being made in the image of God, and designing our own future through our actions today.
Dr. Carson, before we let you go, what do you, as you look back on your life experience, you've accomplished a great deal. You've had an opportunity to give back in some great ways. What maybe gives you most joy and encouragement?
Well, I think, I'm in probably four states a week talking. Just seeing the reaction. I mean, huge record-breaking crowds all over the country, red states, blue states, north, south, east, west. People coming out, starting to be revived, starting to understand that this country is for of and by the people. It's not for of and by the government. It was never intended to be a society where your life was controlled by others. And we've somehow allowed that to happen. And the fact that we can change it, it's not too late, that's what encourages me.
Dr. Ben Carson, who serves as the Director of Pediatric Neurosurgery at Johns Hopkins Medical Institutions, his new book coming out called One Nation, What We Can All Do to Save America's Future. And he'll be sharing at the annual dinner of the Minnesota Family Council Institute coming up on Tuesday, May 6th. You can find out more at Minnesota Family Council, mfc.org. Dr. Carson, thank you so much for taking some time today, and we look forward
always
to hearing.
Always good talking to you.
Hearing more from you, and we'll look forward to having you in the area soon.
Sounds good. Take care now.